mumbled thanks. We visit a little longer until I sense it is time to leave. Mr. Bryant, one last thing and then I'll let you go.
What is it?
The rest of the items that you said you dropped off at the university. Do you remember which one?
It was the one on the west side near their lake. Let's see. What's it called?
I smile at the thought. It's the university where I work. SFSU, San Francisco State University?
Yeah, that's the one. Check with them. Who knows? They may still have everything.
On the drive home, I can't get the journal out of my head. My father was right. It doesn't belong in a museum where people will glance at the cover under glass as they stroll past. There are too many dreams, fears, and hopes embedded in its pages. It's a personal story of a life that needs to be cherished by his family. It belongs to his children, and their children, and then their children. My father desperately wanted to find them. He'd tried every O'Reilly in San Francisco, probably every O'Reilly in California, and, knowing Dad, every O'Reilly across the country. But my father was an ironworker, not a researcher. I, on the other hand, am paid to dig up obscure facts and information. I know the ropes. I have people I can call, places I can look. And now, with the Internet, surely I can track down his family. I owe that much to my father. I owe that much to Patrick O'Reilly. The more I contemplate the task, the more energized I become. It's right down my alley, a job on my own turf. And not just for Patrick or for my father. Deep down, I know this is a job that I need to do for me. My breathing quickens, my thoughts jump around with waving hands. Instinctively, I map out the paths I'll take, the places I'll start. As I do, one obstacle keeps flashing a warning in my head. I've promised the professor that in just a few days, I'll submit a comprehensive outline. I can't do both. I drop the ring on the table. The design is unlike any I've ever seen. The band is formed by what looks to be two connecting arms, each reaching around until they meet. The hands at the ends of the arms are intricate, with every detail of the fingers and nails showing. In the center, where the fingers touch, they hold a small silver heart. And below the heart, in fact connected to it, extends a small crown. I consider what might possess an ironworker to include a ring in the box. I've known many men who worked on the bridge, but most refused to wear jewelry, afraid they would catch it on a rivet and cause injury. Intrigued, I push the ring onto each of my fingers until it slides safely around the third finger of my left hand. I twirl the ring around and again study the design sculpted into the surface. There is something familiar. I'm sure I have seen these shapes before. I sit perplexed until my mind makes the connection. When it does, I jump from my chair. As I hold it close, words from the journal flow from my lips. With this crown, I give my loyalty. With these hands, I promise to serve. With this heart, I give you mine. The crown, the hands, the heart, they are all there. In an instant, I know. On my finger, I wear Anna's ring.
Chapter 21. He didn't need to keep his appointment with the doctor. Not after landing Bikehouse. His boss would never ask about the visits again. Dave had come today because for the first time since their conversations had started, he had something that he needed to discuss. She started first. "Let's talk about baseball," she said. "Baseball? Sure, why not? On your first visit, you mentioned that you once coached a youth team. I'm just wondering, why baseball?" Well, because it's a fabulous sport? He would often anticipate her questions. Not this time. But why is it so great? She persisted. Don't grown men just smack a white ball with a stick and then run around? Dave perked up. You're confusing it with golf. Baseball isn't just smacking a ball. It's much more than that. It's skill, it's discipline, but it's also planning and strategy. It's watching your opponents move and then deciding how best to react. Baseball is symmetry and grace and beauty and power, all woven into a single fabric. Simply put, Doctor, it's a perfect game. While her question appeared to be idle chat, he realized afterward that it was meant to probe his emotion, to gauge intensity. Okay, I believe you. Do you still coach? Coach? No, I gave it up after the accident, Dave said. Why? He paused. She let the silence drag. I couldn't go back. It brought back too many memories. But aren't they good memories? Sure, but I hope you see, David, that it's okay to remember. It won't always cause pain. In time, you'll create new memories, good memories that will blend with the old. Your life will continue. You'll still have hopes, dreams, passions. In short, you still have a full life to live. The idea felt so distant, so unreachable. Instead of accepting her words, pretending to agree, and moving forward, Dave raised a topic of his own. Before we go on, I'd like to talk about my jacket. The one from Megan? Yeah. I told you how I found it, but I didn't tell you the whole story. I'd like to hear it. I didn't tell you that I wore it to work, that I hadn't shaved or showered. I'd been drinking. I was a mess. I'm not sure I follow. I got the account. I got Bike House because of the Harley jacket. Do you see any significance in that? I wouldn't try to read too much into it. Life is full of coincidence. It just has a way of helping us out sometimes. Nothing more than chance? You don't see it as a sign or something? A sign? That's why I'm asking. David, it's normal to want to believe that life is ruled by fate. But be careful about giving away control. If you turn your life over to destiny, then it takes responsibility away from your actions. We'd all like answers as to why awful things happen in life, but the answers are not always there. Sometimes life is awful, just because. Does that make sense? I guess so. You're grieving over the loss of your wife and family. That's the reason we're talking. But understand that life will keep right on going around you. Be careful about stepping off. Be careful about chasing dreams that are only wispy puffs of hope, not based in reality. Be careful about giving up. If getting this account is indeed a sign, as you imply, then it's to tell you to move on with your life, let go of the pain, and move forward. You deserve happiness. His eyes narrowed. His head flinched slightly back. When he finally spoke, his words caught her by surprise. You mention hopes, passions, and dreams, but how far should I go in search of answers? Answers to what, David? To questions like, where do I find the hope you talk about? Where do I find the will to get up each morning and live my life? Where do I find out if there's more to life than just sitting here asking you questions? No offense. I want to understand you completely, David. Can you expound a bit further? His intensity was turning into frustration. I'll narrow it down. Where do I look to make my life meaningful again? It was her turn to pause, to ponder. She picked her words carefully. Many places. I think that you have to look in many places, David. You mentioned that keeping busy at work has helped. Isn't your job meaningful, for one? At times, sure. But if that's the only reason I can find to get up each morning, then smother me with a pillow now. Don't get me wrong. My job can be challenging, but there has to be more to life than strategy data. Look, here's what I'm getting at. Just a couple of months ago, I'd have answered that my family was the place to look. But now, I don't have a family. So with no family, with no wife, and no children, where do I look for meaning? We've already discussed the fact that nobody can replace what you've lost. But David, whether you want to hear it yet or not, you will most certainly love again. She waited for his reaction. I don't think you answered my question, he said. So let me ask it this way. At our first meeting, you told me about losing your fiancé, Jonathan. Yes. You may have mentioned it, but how long ago did he pass? 9 years. And have you found someone else in those 9 years? Shouldn't I be the one asking the questions? Please, I'd like to know. No, not yet, she said. But I'm certain that with time I will. Certain? How do you know? No? I guess I don't know. I simply hope. That's exactly my question, Doctor. That's what I want to know. How far do I go to find hope?
Chapter 22. Every major university library has a special collections department. I've used them often. The books and material are old, frequently historic, generally priceless. None of it can be checked out, but it can be held, read, and studied, if done so with gloved hands, appreciation, and care. I am embarrassed that it hasn't occurred to me before now to search there for items relating to the bridge. I recognize Gwen, the librarian in charge, and she recognizes me. She's a pleasant older woman, and if I was playing my separated-at-birth game, I'd say she reminds me of a modern Mary Poppins. Professor Winston's assistant, right? Yes, that's correct. What project are we working on today? It's an assignment about the history of the Golden Gate Bridge. There's a fun way to spend your weekend. Tell me about it. I chit-chat until the timing is right, then I get to my point. Listen, I'm looking for old books or letters from men who may have worked on the bridge during its initial construction. Do you have anything like that? Honey, we're in San Francisco. We have shelf loads. Notes, letters, pictures, drawings. You name it. It turns out that she is not exaggerating. There are several drawers of letters, minutes from government meetings, photos, even plans and drawings of the bridge. I ask specifically about items that may have been dropped off anonymously years earlier, but she has no way of checking. Anything so acquired would have simply been catalogued eons ago. I take a pile of the material and spread it over one end of a table. The information is fabulous, and I mean fabulous, and I quickly get lost in my work. I'm transported back to a harder, lonelier time. I am reminded of the climate and conditions, of the fact that the country was in the throes of a debilitating depression. August 1934. It is late summer, a time carpenters normally cherish. A time of abundant light and warm weather. That is not the case at this forsaken place. The gate is plunged in cold, wet gloom. During normal times, one would never consider working in such a place. But these are not normal times. Another reads, 1933. Times are tough with the depression going on. There are always men looking for work, and so if you mess up, they let you go quicker than the bay fog. Take time for a smoke, and they replace you. And we only get paid for time put in, no matter how long we've been waiting for work to begin. Even guys out on the steel, where it's cold and miserable as hell, they all just feel damn lucky to have jobs. I leaf through the various notes and letters, pondering the conditions. May 4th, 1934. Never seen a completely calm day at the gate, always windy, a gale that seeks men out. It blows up our sleeves and pant legs, no matter how many layers we wear. When this hellhole ain't windy, we're shrouded in fog. There are days we stand in sunshine on top of the tower, but we never see the water because of the fog. Sometimes it's all around, and you wonder what the hell you're doing out here. Fog, cold, wind in your face, but you stay. And despite the weather, the tower continues to rise. And it is a beautiful sight. As I read, I'm surprised to find that an earthquake struck the bridge while it was being built. The event was recorded by a bridge worker, Frenchie Gales. It was early June. I was on the tower when the quake hit. It was so limber that it swayed 16 feet in each direction. There were 12 or 13 guys on top with no way down. The whole thing would sway toward the ocean, and the guys would say, "Here we go," thinking the tower was going to collapse into the water. Then it would sway back toward the bay. Men were throwing up. I figured if it collapsed into the water, we'd hit the iron first. It never did. As I continue to peruse their words, one fact becomes obvious. Through the insurmountable hardship of bridging the gate, a comradeship developed among the men, a feeling that all were taking part in something historic. A note left by a tower worker makes me chuckle. "We had toilets on the tower where the waste collected in a trap. It was always a temptation to open the trap on one of those passing ships, like dropping a live bomb. Nobody did, of course, till we heard that the Shinsu Maru, a Japanese freighter, would be steaming through the gate. It wasn't long before the war, and the Japs had already invaded Manchuria. A lot of the guys on the crew weren't fond of them. I guess the temptation became too great for one of them. I can't say who, of course, other than to say I heard he figured his precise timing the day before. The next morning, when the ship appeared right on schedule, steaming toward the bridge in the outbound shipping lane, there was a sudden waiting line to use the toilet. Funny how all the guys had to go at once. Well, whoever the culprit was, he missed the smokestacks, but managed a direct hit all over the deck. You could hear the men's hoots and hollers all the way to the shore. The Japanese filed a protest, and inspectors came around asking questions. Of course, nobody knew nothing. Nothing at all.
There are also letters documenting the tremendous amount of concrete and steel consumed by the bridge during its construction. 2 separate concrete plants have been erected, one on each shore. Cement is poured day and night, a huge river of aggregate that never ceases to flow. I would not have believed the scale of this project had I not been here to see it with my own eyes, to touch it with my own hands. And then, another note from Frenchie Gales. There were guys down in the cement who would level it off. At the end of a pour, we took count, and we were one guy short. The pours were deep. Everybody started stabbing around in the cement, trying to find the guy, but we couldn't. The timekeeper asked if I would go with him to notify his family. It was 1:30 in the morning when we knocked on their door. The timekeeper nearly fainted when the missing guy answered the door in his pajamas. He explained that he got tired, slipped out, and went home to bed. That was the last time he ever worked on the bridge.
The name Frenchie Gales appears often. He apparently worked in many areas of the bridge, and I can't help but wonder if he knew Patrick. Were they friends? Did they work together, laugh together, drink together? I continue to sift. There were times when the construction moved along at surprising speed, but other times when the gate refused to be bridled. I find notes from Russell Cohn, a man who headed one of the major construction companies. On October 31st, an unexpected storm rolled huge waves into the gate. They struck the steel form with tremendous force, breaking over the deck of the access trestle. They kept buffeting until the 50-ton tower began to shudder 6 feet forward and back.
The oscillation worked the foundation pipes loose. The trestle groaned and creaked. And then a mountainous wave, higher than any of the others, hit the forms like a cyclone. Before our eyes, it swept a tangled mass of wreckage into the Golden Gate. All we could do was stand and watch. It didn't just tear out the trestle that day. It also tore out my heart. It was 10 months of the hardest kind of work imaginable, and in just one swallow, it was gulped up unmercifully by an angry sea. I am struck by their persistence, amazed by their determination to overcome all obstacles. Just 6 months after the storm had devastated his company's work, Cone notes, May 4th, 1934. I was heartbroken when the storms washed the trestle out into the bay, but we have found the will to move forward. The work continues, and the bridge is now taking on an almost living quality. Today, we rode the elevator some 700 feet up from the tower's concrete base. It was a raw, windy day, perhaps fitting, when we placed the American flag on top of the bridge tower for all to see. For a certainty, the men know now we will succeed. They were asked to tame one of the most treacherous pieces of water meeting land known to man. And they did. They found a way.
Chapter 23. Dave plucked the yellow sticky note from his phone. Gloria's scribbles said it all. 4 more days. And 2 of those are the weekend, Dave added to no one. In 96 hours, Sean R. Safford, one of Bikehouse's top executives, would be sitting in the adjacent conference room with a close circle of highly paid staff. 4 creative types from the company's ad agency would also attend, as well as 3 support staff from Strategy Data. Dave would lead. Brock would assist. Ellen would stand at the door and play boss. She'd shake hands, carry on about new partnerships and working together for the mutual good. PR propaganda. The room would be packed with capable executives watching Dave's every move, listening to his every word. All eyes would be on him. He was the man in charge. It would be dog and pony at its finest. He shouldn't be nervous. Speaking in front of business groups was second nature to him. He'd done it hundreds of times, in groups larger than this one. Why, then, was his stomach knotting? He needed someone to talk with, someone to calm him down. Dave paged through the contacts in his phone, weighed his options. When he dialed a number, a familiar voice answered. "This is Red." "Red, it's Dave." "Dave! I was just trying to call you on the other line. You must be psychic." "Or psycho. What's up?" "Can you come down here right away?" "Is there a problem?" "There's someone here that I'd like you to meet."
"Who is it?"
"A friend. I think you two have a lot in common. I told her you'd be right down, so don't make the woman wait. I have to run. I'll look for you soon. Bye." Click. And Red was gone. Dave's first real ride on a customized bike, besides his initial 2-foot lunge, had come at the end of his first lesson. "A couple of loops around the parking lot," Red had said, "just to get the feel of the machine." By the end of lesson 2, Dave had graduated to the public streets in the vicinity of the Lakeshore location. By number 3, he was testing short stretches of the Garden State Parkway. Dave hoped it would soon be time to hit the open road.
"You look a bit tense today," Red said when Dave walked through the door.
"Tell me about it. I'm meeting with Safford and crew next week. Not sure why, but I'm oddly nervous." Dave glanced around, but he could see no one waiting.
"You said you had someone I should meet?"
"I do." Red's eyes twinkled like stars at midnight. "Dave, have you ever bumped into a person and known from the first moment that they were perfect for a friend?"
"No, I haven't."
"Well, that's what happened.
Red, I appreciate it, but I'm not looking for companionship right now. Red was only encouraged. True, my friend, but sometimes it comes looking for you. She's waiting in the back, so please be a gentleman and at least say hello. Dave was tense and tired. He needed to talk, not engage in some social hour. He protested again as he followed Red through the door into the shop. Red, I'd rather not. The place was empty, except for Red's smile and a gleaming black and red Harley Sturgis. She came in this morning. She's mint. She not only has a belt-driven final drive, but her primary drive is belt-driven as well. I've checked her over, inside and out, and I've never had a bike traded in better condition. I've made a few modifications, but she's mint, and she keeps calling your name. Dave reached down and let his fingers drift over the curves of the tank. He had not expected this. She's beautiful, Red, Dave said. That she is. And the leather's original. Seems the guy spent more time giving her polish than riding her. Here's the thing. I have to ride down to Frederick in Maryland tomorrow to pick up some papers for my sister. I was thinking that you and your new friend could tag along. I've already made arrangements with the boss. We're calling it a test drive. I'd love to, but my presentation is in 4 days. What's your point? You seem wired. Nothing better to settle you down, to get you ready, than a good old-fashioned ride into the caring arms of Mother Nature. Dave pondered while Red pushed. I'm telling you, it'll do you good. What time are you leaving? First thing in the morning? About 6, before traffic gets heavy. Dave touched the bike again and then climbed on. He let out a breath. Couldn't help but grin. Let me make some calls, but... yeah. Let's do it. Chapter 24. Soaring across the open road, leather jacket deflecting the wind, rumbling bike between your legs. It was like a sports car on steroids, an adrenaline cocktail shaken and stirred. Yet it wasn't the power available at the simple twist of a wrist that intrigued Dave. It was the solitude, the peacefulness that came with the ride. It was such a contradiction, such an irony, intensity and energy, and yet serenity. It was watching trees and fields and open sky, understanding that a bigger picture surrounds, a picture that can't be seen from a high-rise office. It was discovering a larger world, and therein, finding yourself. More important, it offered Dave time to think. Rather than take I-95, Red opted for the scenic route, I-78, over to I-81, then down to I-70, and straight into Frederick. It was twice the distance, but that was exactly the point. Just out of Chambersburg, Red pulled off the interstate and onto a frontage road. When he passed Parker's Drive-In, a hometown burger joint, he pulled in and stopped alongside a picnic table in the back. It was badly in need of new paint. Yet, despite the place's dilapidated state, or perhaps because of it, it managed to emanate country charm. Dave parked alongside and shut off his bike. Now that you've had a few hours in the saddle, what do you think? Red asked. She's amazing, Dave replied. And did you see the look from those kids in the school bus? That alone was worth the trip. It's about to get better. They have a pastrami burger here that will cut a month off your life. You want one? Works for me. Watch the bikes. I'll be right back. Treats on me. Dave relaxed at the table. The surroundings were quaint, serene, and he couldn't help but think that Meg would have adored the place. This trip had been a good idea after all. When Red returned, the burgers were all he'd described. Pounds of artery-clogging pastrami piled with enough condiments to feed a small town. Eating, as they soaked in the surroundings, Dave posed the question to Red that had been perplexing him, a question he'd been pondering for the last 200 miles. Red, do you mind if I ask you something?
No. What's up?
It's a question I asked my shrink the other day, and, well, I'd like a second opinion.
I'm competing against a shrink?
Don't worry, I won't sue for malpractice.
Okay, lay it on me.
I'm wondering how far one should go in search of hope.
Sounds philosophical.
I was actually hoping for practical.
What did your shrink say?
She said I'm emotionally vulnerable, that I need to be rational, to think with my head. Otherwise, she suggested I might end up doing something, well, irrational.
Like learning to ride a Harley?
No. Like taking off on my bike and never coming back. Would that be stupid?
I suppose it depends on where you're going and what you'd be leaving behind. Have you thought about it? Just taking off, I mean?
Dave shrugged first with his eyes. I guess I have. The problem is that the doctor's right. I have been a bit unstable lately. I mean, at times I feel like my life is getting back to normal, whatever normal may be. But at other times, I just feel empty. Like the answers are out there somewhere, waiting. And it's up to me to find them.
I guess that sounds a bit bizarre.
Sounds to me like you had a little more motivation to ride a road bike than just market research.
Perhaps.
I just keep thinking about Meg. About a conversation we had about life and dreams and jackets and motorcycles.
Red took another bite of burger and another swallow of Coke, as if that might help him formulate a profound answer.
Not sure what to tell you, Dave. Never been too good with questions like that. I work on motorcycles.
It does seem to me, though, that you may be asking others to decide something only you can answer.
I suppose you're right.
Red hesitated, as if he had more to say, as if he wanted to expound but wasn't sure he should.
What is it? Dave asked.
I guess you just remind me of someone.
Who?
Me.
Dave laughed. Other than his recently acquired affection for customized Harleys, he hadn't figured they had much in common.
And how's that? He asked.
I took off once, just like you describe.
Dave set his burger on the table. The man had his attention.
You're serious?
Red nodded.
Can you tell me about it?
When Red rolled his lips inward, his mustache completely concealed his mouth. It was a moment before he spoke.
I don't mind telling you, Dave. You're my friend. It's just that you need to understand this is my story. I don't want to suggest it applies to anyone else. You understand what I'm saying?
Dave nodded.
I think so. I took off one day on my bike, popped everything and rode away. It was right after the war.
The war?
As a young man, I spent some time in Vietnam.
I didn't know.
Red shrugged.
There's a lot we don't know about the people who surround us.
What happened?
I was drafted in April of 69. I was supposed to ship out 6 weeks later. I didn't believe in the war, Dave.
His eyes narrowed as he spoke.
I wasn't about to go fight in some hellhole halfway around the world, killing people for reasons nobody could explain.
You bailed?
That was the plan. I was going to ride my bike to Canada with some buddies. A lot of my friends were doing it.
So you dropped everything and took off?
No, it didn't work out that way. I got home late that night. Too late. I was going to leave early the next morning, but I'd been drinking. I overslept. My dad was up by the time I got downstairs. The first thing he asked was where I was going. I tried to be funny. Told him I was going down to sign up. He knew I hated the war. I thought it would make him laugh. Only thing was, he didn't get that it was a joke. He got all teary-eyed and started to go on about how proud he was of me, How proud my mother would be if she were still alive. It was the first time I ever remember my dad saying he was proud of anybody. The first time.
What did you do?
I packed up my bike and rode out of the driveway. The only problem was I rode down to the recruiting office. 3 months later, I was sitting in a dirty foxhole near the Mekong Delta, wondering what the hell I'd done. I was just a scared, lonely, stupid kid. I shouldn't have been halfway around the world killing nobody. Not at that age.
Red paused, contemplated his burger as if deciding how to attack his next bite, then chewed slowly. They were in no hurry.
I made a friend there. His last name was Harris. First name was Leslie. What kind of parent would name their son Leslie?
It was a question that expected no answer.
We called him Les. Les Harris. He was a bit older than I was. Actually, he was a lot older. Had a wife and a kid at home. Guess he felt sorry for me, 'cause he always watched out for me. He was just a damn fine person. We were going out on patrol. It was my turn to take the point. It wasn't dangerous. We hadn't run into any VC for weeks. I'd been sick, puking the night before, hadn't slept hardly at all. I felt like hell, and I must have looked it, 'cause Les took one glance at me and said he'd swap me turns at point. He said that I could hang near the back. The route was the same. We would wade across the river and then hike 6 miles, running a perimeter check through the jungle.
Red's muscles tensed.
I was dragging at the back when the gunfire started. It took me a minute to register what was happening. 3 men went down in our patrol before we realized where the shots were coming from. Turned out there were 2 VC hiding in the jungle. By the time we took care of them,
he paused, then turned to Dave.
Took care of them. What a bizarre expression.
He didn't wait for a response.
By the time we killed them, several minutes had passed.
His words slowed.
When I got to Les, he was bleeding from his mouth. He was trying to whisper something, but I couldn't tell what he was saying. I tried, Dave, but with all the blood he was coughing up, I just couldn't make out his words. After a few minutes of trying, he just quit talking, and then, a few minutes later, he quit breathing. He died in my arms. I couldn't help him. I couldn't even tell what he was trying to say.
Red stopped, as if he needed a moment to compose himself. He took a long drink of his Coke before he was ready.
I was so screwed up after that. I can't even tell you how screwed up I was. I came home from the war angry. Angry at the Viet Cong. Angry at our country for sending me there. Angry at life. The whole damn mess just didn't seem fair. Not right at all. It should have been me. A young, stupid kid. To take a bullet to the chest. Not a good man with a wife and kid waiting for him to come back home. After I got back, I went to see his wife. Hannah was her name. She looked so empty, so lost and lonely. I told her how Les had saved me, how I should have been at the front of the line that day. She didn't say it, but I could tell that she was also wishing it. She asked if Les had said anything before he died. I didn't know how to answer. All I could do was shake my head, no. It was a bad war, Dave. Afterwards, I had no direction, no faith in life, no hope for mankind. Frankly, it was hell just to be alive when I should have been the one to die. I drifted for a long time, taking odd jobs to get by, the whole time letting the anger build inside. Then, in 82, I noticed on the news that in Washington they were dedicating a memorial to the war. I went nuts. Completely snapped. They were building a memorial to a damn mistake of a war. Can you imagine that? I decided by then that I'd had enough living in hell and I was gonna do something about it. I stuck a 45 in my saddlebag and headed out on my bike to this so-called memorial. It was somewhere along the ride that I decided when I got there I was going to climb to the top of whatever monstrosity they'd built, and I was going to blow my brains out in front of everyone. A statement to the world about the injustice that had occurred. You don't have to tell me all this, Rhett. I'd like to, if you don't mind. It was strange what happened next, and you may not believe what I'm about to tell you. Have you ever been there? To the Vietnam Memorial? To the wall? Rhett asked. Though Dave had lived on the East Coast for most of his life, he was embarrassed to admit that he'd never visited the site. He shook his head. You should, Rhett chided. I will. I got there, Dave, on a Wednesday morning. It was raining, and there weren't many people around. A good thing, considering my state of mind. I took my gun, and I shoved it into my belt, underneath my shirt. Then I turned and headed toward the wall to make my statement. The walls are made of thick black granite from India. They're about 10 feet high, and each slab is inscribed with the names of thousands of guys like Les, guys who didn't come home. Well, I walked to the wall with a heart full of hate and disgust, but when I touched it, Dave, something went all wrong with my plan. It's hard to explain, but touching the wall, being there, seeing it, a reverence came over me that to this day I don't understand. In an instant, I realized the place wasn't there to celebrate the atrocities of war. That's not why it was built at all. It's there to remember the lives of the guys who died for us. The guys who served. You see what I'm telling you? It ain't about us, Dave. It's about them. The sacrifice that they made. Call it a vision, call it a gift, call it crazy. But in an instant, after I touched the wall, the whole place, well, it felt like hallowed ground. I just couldn't desecrate it by killing myself there. I searched until I found his name. Leslie Harris. I touched his name and I started crying. A big old burly man in a black leather jacket touching the wall and bawling like a baby. Couldn't help myself. I ran my fingers over every letter. And while I was standing there, thinking about Les, I... Red choked up, unable to continue. Dave waited until Red was ready. After I touched his name, Dave, he spoke to me. I know it sounds nuts, and at the time I was, but I swear I heard him as clear as I can hear you today. And there was no question it was the voice of Les. There was no mistaking Les. What did he say, Red? He said that life was gonna be okay. He said that it was worth living. He said to keep hope alive and stay strong for others. And the peculiar part is that, at that moment, I knew he was just repeating the same thing he'd been trying to tell me in the Mekong jungle years before. It sounds crazy, but Les saved me in Nam. And then he saved me again at the wall. What happened next? Nothing. I just kept living. I kept getting up every day, doing the best that I could do. A couple of years later, I met Sherry, got married, had 2 kids. Life ain't always been easy, but I've been getting by okay since that day. I've just been trying to do what Les said. Did you ever go back and find his wife? Tell her what happened? I tried. I looked her up, but she'd moved on. Years later, I heard through a buddy that she'd married again, had a family, that she was happy. I don't know, but I'm guessing that somehow Les spoke to her as well. Red set his empty Coke cup on the table. Dave leaned forward, closer to where his friend sat. At times, Red, I feel a bit crazy as well. Not sure if I can handle it all. Moments when I'm not sure what to do. Just do what I did. What I still do. Keep living. Keep moving forward. Even if it's just a bit at a time. Red stood. I need a refill. Do you want something else? No, I'm good. I wish I had something better to tell you, Dave. I mean, if I had all the answers, I sure wouldn't be a motorcycle mechanic. He turned and walked to the entrance of the drive-in. Dave's reply was low. Too low for Red to hear. Maybe that's why you are. Chapter 25. Dave arrived at the office early. It was becoming a habit. He couldn't sleep at home, and at least this way he would get a parking space. He moved behind the receptionist's counter and flipped a few switches. Lights flickered on with a buzz, interrupting the morning's silence. He tossed his jacket over a chair and headed to the conference room. It was immaculate, every chair in place. Gloria was worth every dime Ellen paid her. He picked up the bound packet from the table. The art department had come through again. Color embossed cover with a gleaming Bike House logo, perfect bound. And the information the book contained was the finest Dave had ever assembled. The data had been analyzed, quantified, charted, and copied. Graphs and pictures had been prepared. It was all there, brightly bundled and easy to follow. A PowerPoint presentation was already loaded on the laptop for projection onto a screen that would roll down from the ceiling at just the right moment. The slides were concise, colorful, and enlightening. It would be the showcase of his career. The showcase. It was odd, really, that he'd wanted the account so badly. Now that it was here, now that the work was done and the presentation would soon begin, he found himself wishing it was over. Brock entered the room at 7. Dave had moved to a conference room chair and was resting his head on the table.
"Are you dead or just practicing yoga?" Brock quipped.
"Good morning," Dave said, sitting up straight.
"You want some coffee?" Brock asked.
"Not yet. I don't want the caffeine kicking in too early."
"Did you bring your jacket?"
"It's in my office."
"Ellen asked about it yesterday. I told her you'd have it. She thinks it's mystical."
"Maybe it is."
"Sure, or maybe you don't give yourself enough credit. I'm telling you, you're going to kill it today. I can feel it. Just make sure you throw in plenty of soul."
The first hint of a smile crossed Dave's face. Brock took a seat beside his friend, then turned quizzical.
"Look, I know that you wanted this account pretty badly. Has it been everything you expected?"
It was casual conversation, words to kill time until the meeting started. It was also the very question Dave had been pondering for the last 20 minutes. He hesitated in his answer.
"I don't know, really. I'm not sure."
Brock shrugged.
"If not, it will be. Hey, I'm going to grab coffee," he said, standing up. "Then I'll be in my office until it's time to start. Are there any changes in my introduction?"
"No, do it just like we discussed. Just like old times." Brock nodded and pulled the door closed with a click, leaving the room's solitude to surround and envelop Dave, as if it were still waiting to hear his answer. "Has it been everything you expected?" At 9 sharp, the elevator doors pinged open and Mr. Sean Safford, Vice President of Marketing for Bike House Customized Motorcycles, stepped out. 5 protégés followed, one more than Dave had expected. Ellen waited with her hand extended. The show was about to begin.
"Mr. Safford, gentlemen, it's great to have you here. I trust you had a good flight."
Dave let Ellen handle the formal greeting, the small talk, the useless chatter about the weather.
"I just wished we'd had some time to ride over instead of fly," Safford added.
Ellen chuckled,
perhaps not understanding the man was serious.
Yes, well, of course. We have some coffee, pastries and such. We can wait in the conference room for the others to arrive.
Dave and Brock shook hands with the entourage. Safford grabbed a pastry and then returned. Not wanting to miss a thing, Ellen stepped into the circle as well.
Dave, have you been out riding lately? Safford asked.
I took a ride over the weekend down to Frederick. He spoke matter-of-factly, as if he spent every weekend on the road.
What did you ride? Safford continued.
A 91 Sturgis. Mint. Ellen nodded to Dave's answer as if the words meant something to her. Safford didn't notice her. His focus was locked on Dave.
How was it? The ride, I mean.
Best ride of my life. Enlightening.
Long rides usually are.
As the conversation continued, a second group of suit-clad executives stepped into the room. Advertising folks. There were more introductions, more handshakes, more business cards exchanged. Four employees of Strategic Data followed, three support staff, and one intern assigned to the project. By quarter past the hour, everyone had filled a plate, and Ellen piped up.
Well, I know you all have busy schedules, so let's get started.
She waited another few minutes as people staked their claims to the various chairs arranged throughout the room. When all appeared ready, she began.
I think you all know I'm Ellen Brewer, president of Strategy Data International, and let me begin by telling you how excited and pleased we are to have such a distinguished group here today.
Dave couldn't argue that Ellen was a good boss, despite her sometimes callous behavior. He'd certainly had worse. And everyone at the firm would agree that her leadership and strategic decisions had been critical in moving the company forward and making it a success.
We're also glad to have you gentlemen from AdCor here today. There's no question that you do a fine job filling the advertising needs of such a stellar company as Bikehouse Customized Motorcycles.
The woman was smart enough to surround herself with competent people. She believed in hiring the best and then paying them well. Not that the money came without a price. Ellen gave her all to the firm, and she expected everyone else to do the same.
And I'd like to thank the people from our own staff in attendance today, who have helped us put this information together.
While she was more than competent, the one trait that Dave found irritating, at times even exasperating, was the fact that she didn't understand when to sit down and shut up.
And as you know, the scope of the study was broad. Who buys a customized bike and why?
Our research may surprise you. While Ellen droned on, Dave began to consider Brock's question once again. Has it been everything you expected? He knew the answer. It was simple. Obvious. He just couldn't bring himself to admit it, or to verbalize it. It begged a follow-up question. If not, then does any of this really matter? Dave let his fingers drift across the surface of his leather jacket. The aroma, the newness, still lingered. It was a pleasing smell. But it also let memories tag along. Memories of Megan, of the children, of better times. Dr. Jaspers had been right. They should be happy memories, joyful memories. Yet, so often, when they surfaced, they brought only loneliness and guilt. Guilt? Strange, but that had never been discussed with the doctor. Why should he feel guilty? It was an accident, after all. And yet, wasn't he the one driving? What if I'd swerved at just the right moment? What if I'd been paying closer attention or just waited 10 more minutes to leave? What if... Brock stood. Ellen had finished. Brock would give a quick introduction, discuss the basis and scope of the study, explain the reasons for their approach. In short, he'd give validity to the conclusions that Dave would present. It was a great format. They'd used it countless times. Dave knew from experience that Brock would take exactly 5 minutes, hitting his mark within 10 seconds either way. It was a speech Dave had heard often, though adapted to each particular situation. Brock had been a good friend, helpful in his own myopic way. He certainly did not understand Dave's loss, but at least he pretended to. Perhaps even wanted to. And Brock's question had been a fair one. Has it been everything you expected? He had expected more, hoped for more. Finding the jacket had been painful, but then to land the bike house account because of it, it seemed like too much of a coincidence. And yet, in just over an hour, the pastries would be gone, the reports would be distributed, the research presented, and conclusions drawn. There would be pats on the back for everyone, whether they deserved them or not. And the men in their tailored suits and women in their designer outfits would wander back to their self-important jobs in their self-serving world. And in the end, Dave wondered, would he have made any difference at all? Would anyone walk out the door a better person? In the end, people would still buy motorcycles. Ellen would continue to fret about next year's growth rate, and Brock would persist in putting the moves on every woman entering his life. But what about himself? Dave questioned. He would continue to drive home each night, alone, to find a cold and empty house, full of nothing but aching memories. A house of misery. I'll now turn the time over to Dave to explain our conclusions and recommendations. Brock's question had been simple. Has it been everything you expected? He would be lying if he pretended it had. Bike house was just Novocaine. Anesthesia, numbing the wound without ever healing it. Inside, Dave was still bleeding. Dave, you're up. Brock's voice hardened. His volume increased. If you'd like to explain our conclusions and recommendations, the time is now yours. Dave stood slowly, all eyes focused on him, tracking his every move. His voice flowed with emotion. I'm sorry. I apologize. I let my mind wander a minute there. That's easy to do when you're thinking about a bike house customized ride. I'm convinced they're the most amazing custom bikes produced anywhere. He paused to collect his thoughts, looking like he didn't know where to start. Ellen gazed around the room, seemingly fascinated by the attention David instantly commanded. By pretending to drift, by acting as if he weren't paying attention, he now had every person in the room staring intently. She hadn't been shy about voicing her support. She'd already told Dave that as far as she was concerned, he was nothing short of brilliant. Now, with simple drama, the crowd was eating out of his hand. Her smile said it all. Give the man an Academy Award. Dave continued. I was thinking about motorcycles because of my jacket, and because of the amazing circumstance in landing this account. You see, I've been in search of something that I've lost. Something that I've been missing for quite a while now. And the funny part is, I somehow got it into my head that I would find my answers here, with this account. Ellen may have been buying into the change of plan, but Brock wasn't. One look at him said he understood that something was terribly wrong. Dave continued. I took a ride this past weekend with a friend of mine. I asked him about my search, and he told me that I'd been looking in the wrong places, that I had to look inside. I've been sitting here this morning, pondering that, but with an inside so hollow and empty that it's hard to say what I expect to find. And then Brock asked me if working on this account had been worth it. It's a simple question. But I realized, and no offense to Mr. Safford, the answer is no. There's something still missing. I'm not sure what. And that's what has me a bit perplexed. His words dripped with despair. Safford cast a glance toward Ellen, who sat forward in her chair for the first